Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
So welcome to the Language on the Move podcast, a channel on the New Books Network. My name is Hannah Torsch, and I'm a lecturer in linguistics at Macquarie University, Sydney, Australia. I'm very pleased today to say that my guest is Joseph Lobianco, a foundational figure in linguistics here in Australia. I could say many things, but I will introduce him as Professor of Language and Literacy Education at Melbourne University. And today we're going to talk about his new book, Community and Heritage Language Schools, Transforming Education, Research Challenges and Teaching Practices, which was co-edited with Ken Cruikshank and Merrill Walin and published by Routledge. Welcome to the show, Joe.
Thank you very much, Hannah.
Now, for those who don't know your very impressive body of work or perhaps are new to this field, could you just start by telling us a little bit about yourself?
Okay, well, thank you for the invitation. I've recently retired from the position at the University of Melbourne in Australia, which I'd had for 20 years. And prior to that, I'd worked in, and even during that period of time at the university, I worked in language policy studies. I started off my academic life as an economist. I was very interested in the integration of migrant populations, particularly migrant women. I worked in that focus of work in light industry in Victoria, but I became less interested in it when it started not to focus on culture and not provide any kind of focus on people's language. And so I retrained as a language person, an educator and a linguist. And then I became slightly uninterested with the descriptive tendencies of a lot of linguistics and became, because I've always really been interested in public action, probably more than anything. And so I started to research policy around language, became actively involved in those things myself directly. Then during the late 1970s, early 1980s in Melbourne and Victoria and other places, I was very involved in activism around these things. And there were some political changes, which meant that I was invited in to put my money where my mouth was. I was basically demanding that governments do better for minority populations. And they said, well, let's see what you would do. So I was invited to draft policies, and I did write these, and I became extremely interested in the traction of ideas. The policies were accepted. The National Policy on Languages in 1987 was the peak. Really, it was the first multilingual policy. Some people say first one ever anywhere, but certainly in English-speaking settings. And then I became very heavily involved in the implementation of this. So I developed a very acute interest in problems of making change real And this moved me away from academic research considerations. I always loved research, but you can't do so many things at once. So I became very actively involved in that. And then because the policy was adopted by government and launched and funded, there was a lot of interest internationally in it, and the early successes that we had, which languages started to boom. We had extraordinary growth in research and interest in translation, in interpreting, in the approach that we took in the policy, which was comprehensive, because most policies, if you look at them on language, they tend to be either just a policy on behalf of the official dominant language of a country. Country X protects language Y, and that's typically what language policies do. Or they tend to be some concession to a minority population, but they don't go very far. We were trying to do very ambitious things, you know, think about public discourse, how people spoke to each other, inclusion of minorities, social cohesion, but also justice and rights questions. And naturally, a lot of opposition grew up against this from people who didn't like what we were trying to do. So the politics of language became my life, really, for many years. And then because of what we were doing, it got noticed by people like Joshua Fishman in the United States, who invited me over and there. And I've never done what I promised him I would do, actually. At one point he said, I really should document this as an experiential process. And I will do that now in my retirement at some point as a reflection on how to do language policy from the inside. Because even though language policy is something that's studied by applied language scholars, they still tend to theorize it a lot. And so its practicality is lost, I think. And I want to re-inject that. But anyway, so this was noticed around the world, and I got lots and lots of invitations to work in different places, including with international organizations like UNESCO and UNICEF and the Council of Europe. And so I started to do assignments on invitation in Southeast Asia, in Samoa, Tonga, Solomon Islands, Philippines, Vanuatu, and then Southeast Asia, mainly, and South Asia, Sri Lanka for the World Bank, and Myanmar for UNICEF, and other Southeast Asian settings, Thailand, Myanmar, Malaysia, Indonesia, Philippines. I went to many assignments in Europe. And so this has been my career since then, working on practical language policy things, which always raise questions of literacy and language study, but also the linguistics of these problems. Who describes what languages? How do they do them? What happens with the work that linguists do? How does it get taken up or not get taken up within practical context? So that became my obsession. And recently, we've just submitted for publication a book on Tunisia that I've done with a colleague. We've looked at language ideological discourses, Arabic, French, the two kinds of Arabic, English, and Berber, and other Amazigh, other language issues there. So it became a kind of reverberating set of discussions and events. So I've had a very wonderful career of working all around the world in different settings on practical problems. And in some places we've produced significant change. I mean, in Thailand, we produced the first language policy in that country that wasn't just about the protection of the national language. In Myanmar, we did extraordinary, you know, 45 public discourses around language rights for minority populations, the learning of the main language by minority populations, which is often also a grievance. So this kind of thing, I did a trilingual policy in Sri Lanka in 1999 and, you know, submitted this and worked with the president's office on the implementation of it. And then it got thwarted by conflicts there. So I've had this wonderful opportunity, and I'm in this part of my career, I want to think about putting down some reflections on this experience.
Oh, thank you. That's so interesting. I'm thrilled to hear that you're going to write a reflection about that process of putting together the national policy on languages, because that's certainly something that continues to be important in the work of myself and other scholars in Australia. So that's really exciting. Okay, but we're here to talk about your new book at the moment. So congratulations on that new edited book. Before we talk about it, so this book, as I said, is called Community and Heritage Language Schools, Transforming Education, Research Challenges and Teaching Practices. For our listeners who aren't really across the community languages sector in Australia, could you just give us a brief overview of it? And obviously it's connected to your own policy activism. How did that happen? How did it come about that it was established in Australia? And how has it changed? How has the policy focus and the sector changed since that time?
Well, it's a long and convoluted story, and I can only tell a tiny fraction of it. But suffice to say that in really nearly every society that I've worked in, I visited and worked with community language schools in Nagoya in Japan, and in these kinds of processes of a community generating institutional structures to support and maintain and transmit their languages to their children is really universal. And in some cases, in some societies, it's heavily repressed, and in other societies, they're actually encouraged. So, but the phenomenon is practically global, I would say, and it tends to be ignored. Most of what focuses the attention of researchers in relation to language education is mainstream or official or dominant schooling. We've had this third sector, you might call it third sector schools. The two sectors other than that are the public government schools and then the independent or private schools, and in Australia, a large Catholic school sector. So they're the two other sectors. And then you have these part-time schools in the main, although some of them are also full-time, that are schools whose primary purpose is the transmission of language and culture to immigrant children, but also increasingly Indigenous children in our society. Now, traveling around the world in the kind of work that I'd done that I described before, I noticed that at meetings in other places, there would be community representatives or even academics who would come and say, look, I'm working with the Chinese schools in Malaysia or something or other. And, they can be mainstream government schools or they can be the part-time schools. And so with Ken and Merrill, we decided that we would hold an international conference to try and do some proper comparative work. This has never really been done. And we had this very successful conference in Sydney, much affected by COVID and restrictions on travel. But nevertheless, it was a very successful conference. And we realized there's a huge unaddressed agenda there. Well, we suspected that. And so we thought we'd produce a volume that started to map out the territory. There's a little bit of a taxonomy that I start to produce in my own chapter, but there's a lot of work that needs to be done into this, but also what needs to be both theorized and then developed in a practical way is, what do we want of these schools? What, if we're adopting a pluralist position where we believe in language rights, what role would we hope for these schools? And then in practical terms, what could be done? Now, in my policy work, right back to the really early 1980s, late 1970s, I worked for government in Victoria, and we promoted all sorts of things like cooperation and integration between these schools. Sometimes these schools use the premises of a mainstream school on a weekend or after hours. And so we used to do very practical things. We did this in 1981. Facilitating the writing up of contracts, of meetings between the two sectors so they could understand each other. Often the teachers are not trained, or they can be trained teachers in another system, but it's not recognised here. We would facilitate collaboration so that, you can imagine the kinds of problems that would be there of a practical nature, of people not understanding each other, of even mistrust, sometimes of much worse things than that. And all of these things were there and in spades, which is a colloquialism for saying in large quantity. And So we started to do lots of facilitation of this. And in 1982, actually from your university at Macquarie University in Sydney, Professor Marlene Norst, who's sadly passed away now, she was commissioned partly through some of the pressure we'd been putting on the federal government to do a survey of these schools as a preparation to some kind of systemic support for them. And she produced a wonderful report. Unfortunately, got repressed by forces who didn't want this report. It wasn't just a survey. She produced a really interesting guide to what could be done. So she went beyond the brief in a very helpful way. But there's always resistance to any kind of progress. We know this. And unfortunately, this got her work got marginalised. But I promoted a lot because I liked her a lot. She was a good scholar and tried to do a great thing, and it's got ignored. But I took that up in my 1987 National Policy on Languages and promoted it, and we got some extra funding for these schools. So they started to be incorporated into the system. So this is what we wanted to do in the book, was to think, well, what do other societies do? Are they marginalized? Are they given municipal level support, but not state or federal government support, depending on the governance structures in different countries? Are they actively repressed, as happens, you know, are they underground schools? This happens in very repressive systems. This can be very dangerous to the lives, actually, of people to engage in this kind of activity. So I think there's a call for solidarity with people who struggle against repression, but also to learn from systems where more substantial work is done. In some systems, government and public education or mainstream schooling only supports prestige foreign languages, and these community languages tend to be marginalized, and they might get some token support or acknowledgement or, you know, given a license to continue to teach, but they're not actually encouraged. And all the community language teaching and language maintenance, as distinct from second language learning, would happen only in those marginal settings. Well, in Australia and many other countries in the world, we have a much more integrated approach where our mainstream schools teach multiple languages, including many community languages. Many students study the language at school, at mainstream school, that they might also study in an after-hours system. So I think, and, you know, I know you, we can go on to this with another question, but I think we need to think imaginatively and in a future-oriented way about cleaning up this mess, as it were, having principles that start from a different basis, not a toleration basis, but a basis of learning for having a different way in which all of these schools, I mean, children just have one brain, the learning goes on in that same one brain. And if that one brain is shopped around different systemic structures, then those structures ought to get their act together rather than the child have to, and the family have to continually adjust to different forms of provision.
Yeah, great. Thank you. I mean, I think for those who are outside of the sector and aren't that aware of it, can you just explain what that discontinuity actually can look like for those who haven't experienced it?
Well, it can look like a child, say, studying whatever language it happens to be, let's say Chinese, in Mandarin Chinese, in a school in Sydney. During the week, they might do a 1 or 2 hour program during the week. So it's not a huge commitment of time. And then because their family might come from Malaysia and be an ethnic Chinese family, but they might not speak modern standard Chinese or Mandarin in their home, the child goes to a Saturday morning school run by the community or an after-hours school 2 days a week. And sometimes that after-hours teaching happens during the same physical in the same physical premises as the week program. Now, there's a lot of issues here. One of them is about the coherence of the pedagogies that are used in the two places, and the wastefulness of the lack of any collaboration between the two systems. Wouldn't it be much better if it were possible for this to be maybe not seamless, that would be our ideal aspiration, but at least less jagged and disrupted, if it were coordinated in some way, pedagogically as well as in other ways, if there were shared knowledge among the different teachers about the individual children? And we'd have to start from a child-focused look, and also be informed by good pedagogical knowledge of language learning processes, and also of the affordances. You know, different systems afford different possibilities. Imagine a highly literate mother tongue speaker teaching on a Saturday or Sunday, but who isn't necessarily a trained teacher. This might be a perfect input for colloquial, continuous, communicative language, and then you might have a more structured, grammar-centered approach in the school system. These are just some ideas that I've had that we could work on, and we've put them into action in some places. But I feel like systems, governments run away from this because it seems to them like an immense problem, you know, a very messy problem. But as I argue in my chapter in the book and at the talk I gave at the conference, I think they're going to have to deal with this at some point because of the radical changes that are happening in the world of communication and learning anyway, that are going to overwhelm all these structures. And we're going to be forced to think about these things differently. And I always think if you can predict a change happening, prepare for it. Start talking about it. Get intellectuals in to start theorizing what's involved. And literacy scholars have got a lot to contribute here. And, you know, people who think about the semiotics of the representation of language with communities. I love partnerships which involve these kinds of interactions, because I've always found them very productive, and I've always tried to set them up. That's what we did in Myanmar in all those dialogues. But sticking with the community language schools, which in some countries, I have to clarify, are called heritage language schools and or heritage languages, and I and other people have resisted that encroachment of that terminology here, not because it's bad terminology, but because typically in English, I think heritage has a connotation of something that's in the past, and, you know, like a heritage facade of a building, or the heritage, you know, which might be the historical memory of a community. I'm not saying it's inevitable that it has that connotation, but I think it often does. And whereas a community language suggests that it is something that's present and vibrant and vital within an existing alive community now. So I've preferred it from that point of view. But in the book, we say community / heritage, because obviously other people use the other terminology. And of course, we can inject new meaning into terms. You know, we don't have to be defeated by past ways in which words work. But, so anyway, there's that kind of issue there.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care, and we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it, all while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Yeah, that's great. Thank you. I'm now rethinking my my use of heritage language in my own work. So that's great to think about that. So I'm really interested in this argument that you make in your chapter, as you said, about changes in our understanding of what literacy is. So you have a chapter in the book which is based on a talk you did at the conference. In that, the chapter which is introduces the volume, which is called Community / Heritage Language Schools, Transforming Education, More Than Complementary, Beyond Integration. And as you've already said, so you think schools need to, systems need to really grapple with this idea that you can't have these two sectors not talking to each other, that it's not in the interest of the learner. And you argue that in part because of this this idea of the way in which literacy, our understanding of what literacy is changing as a result of technology, of the fourth industrial revolution. Can you tell us a little bit more about that for our listeners? I realize they have to go read the chapter, but just a little bit of a précis for them to draw them in.
It's an immense topic, of course, but if you look at any organization that has worked in literacy for a long time, you can't fail to notice that they have adjusted their definition of what it is. And the one organization whose definitions I have studied is UNESCO. And of course, they're a very important organization in this because when they were founded from the very beginning, they were given the world mandate, I would call it, for a kind of global agenda for literacy in the world. That's how I've described it in a publication. And if we look at how they understood literacy in the late 40s, early 1950s, and compare it to how they understand literacy today, it's cheese and chalk, two very, very different notions. And teachers and researchers have done this. I mean, there's been many movements in this. And one of the most important one was the new literacy studies of the 1990s, which started to inject social understandings of literacy and move away from a pure psychometric or cognitivist approach. And of course, it's moved on even a lot since then. So what we know is that what is taken to be literacy has expanded beyond simple capacity to read and write a language to multiple other dimensions of what's involved in being a literate person in a society that penalizes people who are not literate. This is the really important social consequence of this. You know, that we have the social cost of, it shouldn't be like this, but it is, the social cost of low literacy, in even understood in traditional ways of understanding literacy, is very, very high. Risk of high unemployment, risk of, it's no accident that a really high proportion of prisoners in jails are low literate people. And it's there are multiple explanations for this. It's not a predictor, it's a consequence of the social punishment. But I'm very committed to this because both my parents were very low literate people. Neither of them had any serious formal education. And yet they were both very intelligent people. So we can't make any kind of connection between intelligence, this opportunity that attaches to literacy. So this is an enormous discourse, and I'll just leave it planted there. But what I did want to say about this is that what's changed in literacy from the 50s, our understanding of it, to now, has been the social dimension. But what's changing increasingly now is a massive technological injection in which multimodality is the principal characteristic of literacy. I mean, anything we do online is not, cannot be reduced to language-centered semiotics. It involves manipulation of multiple semiotic resources that are not just linguistic anymore. So, you know, color, movement, image, there's any number of things that go into a very complex meaning-making practice. This is going to continue to accelerate in what some people call literacy 4.0. My colleague Leslie Farrell, Professor Leslie Farrell at Melbourne University, uses that term, which mirrors Industry 4.0, that is the fourth industrial revolution, which is not just computers, but artificial intelligence beyond computing as a practice that people are in charge of, to actually machines. And it's absurd in a way to call them machines anymore, but machines which learn and learn in, can learn independently, generate their own kind of knowledge, and then project that into the space of meaning. So we've got something really radical going on, and that's going to change how language works. I think one of the reasons we have a crisis in language study today, and this is very true, sadly, in English-speaking countries in particular, English-dominant countries in particular, I think we have the biggest struggle for language teaching and learning that we've had for many years. And this is that people misunderstand the technologies as obviating the need for language study. And that's because they're very reductionist about what's involved. So they take, like people used to take literacy in this very reductionist, simple way, they take language to be very reductionist, and they tend to think, oh, it's just basic communication. So we can inject that stuff, and with voice retrieval, you know, you can ask your little pen to say something in Japanese, and you'll hand that to someone, and that little, it'll say good morning in Japanese. Now, this is completely possible. You know, it exists. You know, there are very sophisticated technologies that will even do lip syncing so that you'll look like you're speaking the language when you take a video of yourself speaking German or Italian or whatever it happens to be. So this is going to be a battle that we have to persuade administrators and other people that language learning is not this. This is forms of communication. Let's welcome them. Let's adopt them. Let's embrace them. We can't deny them. They're there. They're going to grow. Elon Musk wants to inject probes or whatever they are, implants in people's brains. To, you know, all of these things are going on at a very rapid rate, and some of them might be ethically very, very, very questionable. But I can't see any way they're going to be stopped or slowed down until we get on top of what they mean for people. So we have to understand them. And what they mean is that people's learning will be occurring in places other than in schooling, that it'll be self-generated and generated by outside forces, including machines, that it's going to be massively challenging to everything that curriculums, official curriculums, require and prescribe in schoolings, in schooling. And this is going to create, I think, for Indigenous populations, for everybody, but for Indigenous populations, and especially also for dispersed small populations. I worked with a Tigrinya community in Melbourne many years ago with a very small population in Melbourne, but who had other members in Brazil and in Africa and in Italy and other places. And I mean, you can aggregate numbers and communities with the technologies that you can't do otherwise very easily. So there are multiple benefits that we can point to, individualization, aggregation, personalization, learner control, and pacing. There's lots of pedagogical impact that a learner can play, it can govern in this. So the challenge for schooling is absolutely foundational, almost existential, I would say, and therefore we have to embrace it. And so in my chapter, and I only just make a small dent into the problem, we have to think about a new way to imagine learning and start from there. And the school systems that currently are the principal institutional ways of delivering learning have to be redone. And they have to be seamless, and teachers have to be managers of the educational experiences of learners. That's how I call them, rather than the exclusive input to the learner. So they have to understand the principles of the acquisition of language knowledge. So more interactions. I see a bigger role for professional language specialists in this, to interact with practitioners directly, but also curriculum writers and others. We have to rethink these things. And then communities who own community language schools or heritage language schools, and who are the repositories of the communication in these languages, you know, the Arabic and the Tamil and Vietnamese and Greek in Sydney and everywhere else in Australia and other countries. You know, a large part of what's involved in learning is interaction with speakers. So we have to make sure that there's seamless connection there. So I'm just touching on the outlier of this, but that's what I'm trying to do with this, is to get people to imagine more creatively, pushing ahead, but not that far, because these things are imaginable within a decade, and many of them exist now. Instantaneous translation, voice to script. I mean, all of these things challenge all the separations we've ever had. You know, what is literacy going to be when it's possible to have no division between spoken language, sign language, and their representation in a written form or some other form? You know, they're really important questions to ask, and to be asked by people who are interested in multilingualism.
Yes, so much to think about. And I guess this kind of question you've sort of answered, but I want to make sure I've understood, and maybe you can elaborate a little bit. So, for mainstream teachers, this is the question you pose at the end of your chapter, and that somebody asked you, and I really was interested in this. What can mainstream teachers do in order to support the learning of community languages? And it sounds like you're saying that they are also a really important part of this process of this existential crisis that we're seeing in education when it comes to both language and literacy, what they mean.
Yeah, I'm often asked this question by mainstream teachers when I give talks, and as I said before, possibly I'm speaking to Indonesian teachers in Victoria tomorrow, and one of the anticipated questions is exactly this. Even though they're specialist teachers of Indonesian, mainstream teachers often, you know, goodwill ones with goodwill want to know what they do, and when you look at the students who drop out of language programs. I did a study once in the western suburbs of Melbourne in working class schools. We interviewed and discussed and did Q sort analysis, a special kind of subjectivity analysis with large numbers of kids, and we published it in a book in 2013 out of Multilingual Matters. And one of the things that we found in classified students according to their at a critical age in which they were going to continue or drop language, and we language study, and we classified them as waverers or committed kids. And then we worked heavily with the waverers to think about what was it that was going on in their minds that were going to. And one of the things that came up repeatedly is something that mainstream teachers have got an enormous amount of influence on, and not just the language teacher. And that is the attitude or ideology that's attached to the practice of language teaching and learning. We found that lots of students had imbibed a negative, sometimes quite racist, construction of what they were engaged in. And this was not coming from the language teacher. This was coming from systemic imagery and systemic, often not even openly hostile, but just the way life is organized. Anyone who's had children or raised children or been around children, little children, I mean, knows quickly that they are semiotic sponges. They pick up signals from multiple sources. They know when something is half-hearted. In the book, I called it half-heartedness. When schools are just half-hearted about something, kids get it. They know that this is less important than something else. You're not actively saying that learning this Japanese or Italian, the two languages in that particular volume, is less important than doing something else like sport. But I see all the way the school is arranged, and I can work out that that's exactly what you're doing. And one of the girls that I interviewed said this to me. She said, they don't really, really mean it. We can tell. So, you know, why are they pretending? So this is something that mainstream teachers can do, be enthusiastic supporters. You know, I helped introduce a CLIL program in a Japanese school, where the boys, it was a boys' school in this particular case, had a mostly grammatical or formal syllabus. They were doing fine. And as soon as the Japanese teacher started to teach content that was about the Fukushima earthquake and, you know, really interesting material, which the kids had to research online, and the teacher had to, he had to teach technical language ahead of time so they could manage to read these complex texts and stuff like that. The first thing that happens is pushback from the mainstream teachers. Oh, geography, that's my space. Or, oh, science and physics, that's my space. You're just a language teacher. So, you know, that was all resolved beautifully when the teachers understood that the purpose of the CLIL program was for the teacher, the language teacher, to enrich the content in the Japanese program. And it wasn't the exclusive teaching of the science or geography. And then they started to see the benefit of extra focus or additional focus on the content that they were teaching as specialists. So the collaboration was brought about. These conversations between the mainstream and the specialist language teachers are essential. And the mainstream language teacher can either choose to be an innocent bystander, an active supporter, or at least an encourager. Because, you know, again, it's this same one mind that these children have, one mind, one heart, that gets shipped around to different classes. And the multiple messages that they pick up about choices they need to make are significant. So that's something I would say in relation to that question.
Great, thank you. Yes, I know that study well. I've used it in my own research. It's fantastic. Yes, and I think that it's really helpful to teachers, and I know we have education students who listen to the podcast, so really helpful to know what they can do. So that was really my last question, but before we wrap up, I just want to know, you've talked a little bit about your next project on Tunisia, which is a fascinating context, so I'm excited to hear about that. What else is up next for you?
Well, that one's in press. It's under review. I'm working with a dear colleague in Sri Lanka. I had lived and worked in Sri Lanka, and Dr. Harsha Wijesekera and I are putting together a volume on schools, bilingual education there. And bilingual education means typically English plus either Sinhala or Tamil. And that's a project that will come out next year. I've got a book coming out with some colleagues from Hong Kong Uni on supporting learners of Chinese, and these are all things that are in train. There's a lot of other work. I'm much less efficient than I used to be because of illness and old age, both of which have made me slow down. But I really, really want to go back into the theory of language change and deliberate language change. I mean, language always changes. You know, everyone knows that language is a dynamic process and change, but language policy and planning is deliberate language change. And even deliberate language change can happen unconsciously. But planned deliberate language change, which is what I call language policy. And as I said, Joshua Fishman, when I first met him, said that I should document this, you know, my kind of insider account of policy writing. And that's what I want to devote some time to. But unfortunately, I was trained as an academic in an era in which, you know, you've made a distance between yourself as a scholar and the subject matter. And I know that, you know, I haven't done that for years, but that's still my predilection. And I have to overcome that a great deal to speak personally in this way in writing. And I need to do that. But that's something I want to do. I've got a huge amount of documents from, you know, like 45 years of engagement in language policy, agitation and writing and stuff and criticism. But also, you know, you can't just criticize if you want to. I mean, a lot of language scholarship is dominated by a critical disposition these days, especially sociolinguistics. And, you know, that's been important to uncover and expose a lot of injustices and hierarchies in the world. But I don't think we should overstate the agentive power of our disciplines to really affect change, you have to engage with processes of concrete change, and you have to not set aside criticism, but make criticism productive. And I find that, unfortunately, a lot of critical scholarship, maybe not a lot, some critical scholarship is not so productive. And if you want to be productive, you have to engage with people whose views are different from your own. You have to compromise on things. You have to find conceptual categories that unite differences. And, I mean, in very difficult space, when I was working in Myanmar and south of Thailand, where there's been a conflict for many years in which language and script and bilingualism are implicated issues, it's really, really indispensable. It's not just a methodological, I think it's an ethical requirement to adopt a different set of understandings and practices. And criticism is something that has to be understood as being particular to some purposes and not others. So I do think that there's too much mindless criticism, too much of a disposition to begin activity with a critical air. Having said that, I don't want to be assumed to be anti-critical. Criticism is critical to civil life, to decent life, to social improvement. I just think that there are moments of productive participation in shared creation of new things in which criticism can be a problem. And I've seen that to very bad effect. I've seen it from people who've been trained just in the critical tradition who don't know when to stop. So that's something I'd like to do. I want to think about that a lot. And I haven't written enough about that. And I read other people's writing on this and I learn from it. But I feel as someone who's tried to write language policies and be engaged with concrete, productive change and not just analysis or critique, that's something that I want to think about more carefully.
Oh, that's a really wonderful place to end, I think, on that. What do we do beyond criticism, especially for emerging scholars and research students? So fantastic, fantastic. Look, I would love to keep going, but I have to wrap up. So thanks again, Joe. Thanks for listening, everyone. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe to our channel, leave a 5-star review on your podcast app of choice, and recommend the Language on the Move podcast and our partner, the New Books Network, to your students, colleagues, and friends. And until next time.